Welcome to the Arab Spring, a history. Episode 18, The Fall of Nasser. Nasser hit the apex of his rise to power during the last episode. He was by far the most powerful figure in the Middle East, being president of the United Arab Republic, which was itself the leading figure of the United Arab States. He had become a global figure, a symbol for all the countries who wanted no part of the Cold War, and a symbol for those who would fight against colonialism. Egypt had won. Egypt was doing great. The only problem with this vision was that it was more of a mirage. Egypt was not in a good way. It was a very poor country economically and had very low standards of education, not to mention divisions between nationalists and pro-Arabists, secularists and Islamists, which had yet to be resolved. Nasser was a good general and an able politician, but did he really deserve to be one of the world's leading figures? Not really. He could see an opportunity when it presented itself, but considering the speed with which the United Arab Republic fell apart, it should be clear that spotting an opportunity is not the same as exploiting it. The West was certainly not shy about being delighted that Syria had broken with Egypt, as was Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Jordan. Opinion had turned on him in Syria, and in Yemen too, as the United Arab States broke apart. All this propaganda against him was not a disaster, though. His own propaganda machine was by far the most advanced in the region. Nasser's reaction to the collapse of the UAR was to fully explain his Arab socialism in the Charter of National Action, essentially an adaptation of Marxism and European socialism for Egyptian needs, which came out in 1962. The document was one of secular socialism, in which democracy and nationalisation were encouraged, but private ownership and religion were not discouraged. It was highly ambitious, seeking to create a new system of national government, the Arab Socialist Union. It was a very interesting plan, but suddenly implemented government systems forced upon a country from above are rarely successful. Things continued to get worse for Nasser. In 1962, pro-Egyptian elements in the Yemeni army revolted, declaring a republic, which Egypt quickly promised to support. That the event is known as the Egyptian Vietnam should tell you enough about this conflict. A long, drawn-out war in hostile terrain against guerrilla forces, which was deeply unpopular at home. A series of coups in Iraq and Syria in 1963 also promised much, but, as should be abundantly clear from last week, the Ba'athists had very little in common with Nasser. Talks took place for unifying the three countries, but these predictably fell apart. Nasser didn't help the situation, dominating the talks. The relationship between the states got worse following the suppression of a pro-Nasser coup in Syria, leaving Nasser to publicly criticise the Ba'ath. Quite clearly, an Arab political union was some way off, and Nasser would have to postpone what he termed unity of aims, instead focusing on unity of ranks. Egypt may have been increasingly powerful, but it would not do to forget how badly it had been beaten by Israel in recent years. The Arab nations surrounding Israel appeared to be arguing. What was to stop Israel taking advantage of this to pick them off one by one? Such a notion haunted Arab nightmares. So, to try and stop such an incident, In 1964, Nasser invited all the heads of state of Arab nations to Cairo. This must be described as a success. So successful, in fact, that it was decided that meetings between them should be more regular. Burnt bridges between Nasser and pro-Western governments were repaired, and there was some unification of Arab military command. But surely the most important event was the setup of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. The PLO would represent the Palestinian people and have its own army, but it was no government. King Hussein of Jordan made it clear that the PLO would have no authority in Jordan. Also, reflecting the anti-Israel nature of the talks, it was decided to divert the sources of the River Jordan, which were in Arab territory, to cause problems for Israel's plans of irrigation. This meeting seemed to cause as many problems as it solved. The plans to divert the Jordan had numerous problems, showing how little mutual trust there was between the states. 1964 contained the abdication of King Saud in Saudi Arabia, who was replaced by his brother, King Faisal. Faisal would prove a rival to Nasser, as Saudi Arabia was becoming a rival to Egypt. Egypt leading the radical, socialist and secular group of Arab states, while Saudi Arabia was more conservative and Islamist. A key issue was Yemen, with neither side willing to compromise. 40,000 of Egypt's best troops were held down there, when they could have been used in Egypt as trouble was brewing with Israel. There was more trouble with Syria as the extreme Ba'ath wing took power in a coup in 1966. While hostile to Nasser, the Ba'ath were more hostile to Israel, and the result was a defensive pact between the two countries signed in November of that year. A Palestinian attack sparked an Israeli counterattack in the West Bank, which followed with a revolt which was difficult to put down. Tensions only heightened over the spring of 1967. This was not just a regional tension either, it was global. While the US president of the day, the Democrat, Lyndon B. Johnson, was less interested in foreign policy than his predecessor, John F. Kennedy, he did have particular support for Zionist factions within the US. As for the Soviets, they were tied closer than ever to Egypt, following a state visit by Nikita Khrushchev in 1964 to see the opening of the High Dam. This looks a lot like a world getting ready for war. But, I hope you are asking, how does détente fit into this? The world reached the closest it has ever come to a global nuclear war in 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Americans and Soviets played a dangerous game of brinkmanship, but luckily for the world, someone blinked. Russia pulled back at the last minute, introducing a period of détente. Détente was peace between the two powers, at least directly, as tensions cooled and relationships thawed. The doomsday clock rolled back from 7 minutes to midnight to 12 minutes to midnight in 1963. This was all well and good, but it was all very embarrassing for Russia, and for its leader, Khrushchev, and in 1964 he was replaced by Leonid Brezhnev, a far more military-oriented personality. Real détente would not begin until Nixon came to power, which brought the SALT talks and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And until that came, there would be a rough few years. The fact that the doomsday clock returned to 7 minutes to midnight in 1968 should give you some idea of what is about to happen. Tension was high between Israel and Egypt as 1967 progressed, with intelligence reporting that Israel was preparing an attack on Syria. Nasser responded by asking the United Nations Emergency Force on the Sinai Peninsula to be removed on the 18th of May. And Nasser moved troops into Sinai and announced that Israeli ships would not be allowed through the Straits of Tehran. King Hussein moved to Cairo to sign a defensive pact. it was clear to all that war was coming. Nasser was relatively happy, but he had too much confidence in Field Marshal Ameir. He overestimated the ability of Arab troops. He seemed to neglect the fact that there was very little coordination between Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, and he mistakenly believed that America would hold Israel back. Realistically, there was only one way the conflict was going to go. Nasser had promised the Soviet Union that Egypt would not attack first, so pressure built up in Israel to open the Straits of Tyran to their shipping. International pressure was not doing the trick, so Israel felt forced into taking action. The inevitable happened on the 5th of June, 1967. All 17 of Egypt's airfields were attacked by Israel, destroying almost all of its air force. A push across the Sinai began on the 6th of June, and on the 9th, they reached the Suez Canal with 10,000 Egyptians dead. Meanwhile, Israel had attacked Jordan, taking the West Bank and the Old City of Jerusalem. Syria, meanwhile, made probing attacks in the north. The UN called for a ceasefire, which Egypt and Jordan accepted, so Israel attacked Syria and stormed the Golan Heights before accepting a ceasefire on the 10th of June. That was the Six-Day War. By taking the Golan Heights, Israel had eliminated Syria's strategic advantage in the north, had captured Jerusalem and the remaining areas of Palestine, while 200,000 more Arab refugees fled into Jordan. It was a crushing victory, and by acting with speed, had won the war before the Soviet Union could assist its allies. With the exception of French President de Gaulle, Western opinion was universally sympathetic to Israel and hostile to the Arab states. Nasser felt the same way about them, breaking off relations with America and Britain, expelling their citizens. Nasser's responsibility for the debacle was not missed by anyone, and his reputation plummeted. He had attempted to resign, but public opinion kept him in office. Nonetheless, there was severe unrest in both the military and among students, but he used the trouble with Israel as an excuse to delay much-needed reform. In November 1967, he accepted UN Security Council Resolution 242, that Israel would return occupied land in exchange for the Arab states recognising Israel. This plan was not put into action. Low-scale war continued, some victories for Egypt, some heavy victories for Israel. On the 23rd of July, 1970, he accepted the Rogers Plan for Peace, very similar to UN Security Council Resolution 242. The event was a national embarrassment for the Arabs, and intensified anti-Western feeling. Governments were toppled in Sudan and Libya, with left-wing generals taking power in both countries. While the name Colonel Jafar Nimeiri of the Sudan is probably unfamiliar to you, I fully expect you to be familiar with the general who took power in Libya, a certain Muammar Gaddafi. Though, this was probably of little comfort to Nasser. His position was quite clearly in decline. King Faisal was becoming the new face of the Middle East, representing the rich Arab oil states. The other blow was that the Palestinians felt they could no longer look to Arab states to achieve their independence, looking instead to the PLO. As a civil war broke out in September 1970 in Jordan, between Jordanians and Palestinians, an emergency summit was to be held in Cairo. It was there, on the 28th of September 1970, that a no doubt exhausted Gamal Abdel Nasser suffered a fatal heart attack. He was only 52 years old. A symbol of pride for the Middle East, and Egypt in particular, he was, if anything, a victim of impossibly high expectations. Whether he should be judged a failure for coming so close to unifying the region before it all slipped away, or a genius for holding the region together for so long, is for you to decide. In this podcast, I am nothing but the humble narrator. it is for you to form your own opinions. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please visit us online, thehistoryofpodcast.com, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast, twitter.com/thehistoryofpod, youtube.com/thehistoryofpodcast, and thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com. Having spent most of the last 8 episodes focused on Egypt, it is probably about time that we move around. We left everywhere around the Second World War, and we now need to catch them up into the 1970s before we catch up with Iran, and a story which will take us into the 1980s. So, next time, we will return to where it all began. Turkey. Allah.